Sperio. Hello, hello, and welcome to the local voice of our hemisphere. I'm Amy Battistiache, and I'd like to welcome back to the airwaves Kendra Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank Say you, that again.
Amy. I'm very glad to be back on the airwaves.
You are,
and I think
you are.
I'm now actually on the airwaves. Thank you, Amy. I'm very glad to be here on Sperio once again after my, I was probably 6 weeks or so that I was off in other parts of the hemisphere. And now I'm back here to my tea.
Woohoo! So, of course, we have you here with us. We can go back to our original Sperio lineup of having multiple Sperio co-hosts in the studio. It's a lovely thing. And we also today are lucky to have a guest with us. We have Nathaniel Raymond, one of the senior strategists from Physicians for Human Rights. And...
Thank you very much for having me.
And it's going to be a really neat show to talk with. We'll be talking mostly about human rights abuses, specifically in the context of the United States, a very, very important part of our hemisphere.
Indeed, considering it's the part of the hemisphere that we're in, and that that our role in the rest of the world, specifically in terms of what the United States military and such interrogation techniques and torture, and the role of Physicians for Human Rights in their work to try to end that torture that we're continue to be, what's the right word, torturing, participating in. So very soon we'll be speaking with Nathaniel about that. And but of course, we'd like to remind our listeners, as we always do, that they can call us here at the studio, 617-253-8810, to join in the conversation or ask a question. We always like to hear from you. And also to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT.
And if you would like... you can look this song, this show up, as well as previous shows, on the internet at www.wmbr.org, and you can find the archived shows of Sperio there, as well as any of the other fabulous programming that we produce here at WMBR. And Kendra, we were talking before the show about how we have links now on our website to various previous Sperio shows. That's on the Western Hemisphere link, is that right?
Indeed it is. Sperio Once Upon a Time was a project, and still is a project, of the MIT Western Hemisphere project, and therefore on the website web.mit.edu/hemisphere, there's a link to the Sperio website where there's MP3s of many, many of our past shows, and eventually this one once we get it online as part of our archives.
Exacto. Y como siempre, si ustedes tienen interés en hablar con nosotros en español, siempre se puede. Se puede llamarnos al 617-253-8810.
And before we get into the meat, or perhaps the tofu, of our show, we thought we'd kick it off with a little bit of music to put you in the mood. I've been going, those of you who've been listening regularly know that I've been on this this project to reclaim the older Nueva Canción music. So I found a Mercedes Sosa CD. So we're going to listen to Una Canción Posible, sung by her. And then we'll jump right in with Nathaniel Raymond from the Physicians for Human Rights group. Stay tuned.
Dame una leve canción, un trozo de pan, la lucha de cada día, que vivir sin esta vida es imposible para mí. Dame las uvas y el sol, la bella emoción de amar bajo las estrellas, que vivir sin esta vida es imposible para mí. Dame una nueva ilusión, la luz de un volcán, la rueca de la esperanza, esta tierra sea posible por sus viejas cicatrices, por sus tristes mutilados, los que han muerto despojados, los que nombro enamorado, los que lloro derrumbado, los que canto desangrado, los que van siempre a mi lado con su sueño desvelado, los que han dado su costado para los desamparados, victoriosos, torturados, pero nunca derrotado. El futuro está en mis manos y en mi amor apasionado. El futuro está en mis manos y en tu
most amazing Mercedes Sosa, coming to you on WMBR Cambridge. You're listening, of course, to Sferio, the local voice of your hemisphere. And I'm Amy. We have Kendra here with us, back from her travels through the Americas. And we also have in the studio Nathaniel Raymond, who comes to us from Physicians for Human Rights. And it's such a pleasure to have you here with us.
It's a real pleasure to be on the program.
So exciting. So right before we started the show today, we were talking about how amazing it is that we have a guest whose work is now pretty much in the news. It's been something that's been happening with us more and more on Sferio as the things we've been interested in and trying to bring a light to are suddenly being picked up finally by the rest of the media. Maybe we could talk a little bit about what's been going on in the last couple of days and how that relates to your work with Physicians for Human Rights.
Well, in the past 3 or 4 days, we've seen some incredible developments in terms of U.S. interrogation policy. The White House has been brazen enough to say that they have the legal right to waterboard in the future, and previous uses of waterboarding were illegal because the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice said it was okay. Additionally, Vice President Cheney has said that the White House claims legal authority to use these tactics, but meanwhile, something else is happening. Director of CIA General Michael Hayden is contradicting the White House and saying that waterboarding is illegal, and under current law, it probably would not be allowable for the CIA to use those tactics again. So right now we're seeing, with the CIA tape investigation, a really critical juncture in trying to get accountability and clarity about the law as it relates to torture.
It's just such an amazing moment to live in. And you can see that kind of breaking apart of the united front, I guess you could call it, of what was up until recently a one solid statement to the press from the government's point of view. How do you there's just so many questions. It's hard to figure out where to start. But I guess I would say, how do you interpret what is happening right now? And maybe we could step back from that actually first and talk about a little bit what you do with Physicians for Human Rights.
Well, a key part of what Physicians for Human Rights has been doing since the allegations of abuse at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay came to light over the past now, almost 4 years, has been to really shed a light and demand accountability for the role of health professionals as both designers, implementers, and supervisors of what's called the enhanced interrogation techniques. That's a synonym for torture. And those techniques really came out of the expertise of psychologists. And those psychologists, many of the critical ones who were involved both with the Central Intelligence Agency and with the Department of Defense, came out of a program called SEER, which stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. And that program was really sort of a training program for U.S. Special Forces and aviators, people who could be captured by enemies that do not observe the Geneva Conventions. Those tactics were part of this training program, were basically reverse engineered, we've discovered, as part of the United States' descent into becoming a torturing nation.
So, in other words, we took what psychologists had produced to teach our troops how to avoid
or protect themselves from
torture techniques.
Yes.
And then we basically went backwards from there and said, oh, these are torture techniques that we could use against potentially what was the phrase?
Against
at-risk personnel.
At-risk or high capture
high
susceptible.
Capture, yes. Yeah. High capture system. Yeah, there's a whole language you have to learn when you're talking about these.
I'll try not to speak an acronym tonight, which is, you know, I suffer from acronym syndrome, being a human rights worker. But the situation was with September 11th that from 1995 on, the U.S. was basically engaging what's called tertiary torture. They were outsourcing torture through the Central Intelligence Agency's Extraordinary Rendition Program, which began in the Clinton administration. People often
people
forget
that.
People
don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, you know, it's easy to get angry at Bush, but it's not a Republican or a Democratic problem. It's a policy problem that transcends both parties, and people need to be clear about that. I think it's easy to, you know, hang Bush from the gallows of public opinion, rightfully, on this issue. But the fact is, we have to look at the larger legacy. And by the time we got to 2001, really the involvement of psychologists in the SEER program was to fill a human resources crisis where they did not have people trained to torture. And so they took them from places like Fort Bragg and used psychologists to torture potential terrorists.
And was this, why does this program need to start in 1995? You mentioned that it was starting. Was that in response to things happening in the world? Had we not been engaging in torture or enhanced interrogation techniques up until that point?
Well, there's sort of several different strands of the history of U.S. involvement in torture. And I think looking at the involvement of the United States in torture related to counterterrorism, it really begins in 1995 with the rise of Al-Qaeda. And you have the first World Trade Center attack. And it was in response to that that the Clinton administration began the Extraordinary Rendition Program. What the Bush administration did is they took that program in-house. And they developed through the black sites, first and foremost, at a air base, a secret facility in Thailand called Udorn Air Base, a guy named Abu Zubaydah, who is believed to be a chief logistics officer for Al-Qaeda, was captured in a firefight with Pakistani authorities and U.S. intelligence in 2002, and he was taken to this base. And according to a report in Vanity Fair from last year, he was there by interrogated in the presence of both CIA and FBI agents and by two psychologists named James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. And these guys had formerly served in the SEER program as part of something called the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency, which is to help captured American POWs who are suffering from trauma related to torture and abusive treatment get over that experience. It was Mitchell and Jessen, according to sources, including FBI sources who witnessed it, who did things to Zubaydah, including the allegation that he was waterboarded and threatened to be buried alive.
Whew. Yeah. It's all in the name of counterterrorism.
That's right. We're keeping people safe, man.
Well, if this is safety, I don't want to be safe in that
right.
sense.
Yes.
Right. I don't know if you are allowed to share this with us on the air, but does Physicians for Human Rights have contact with Mitchell and Jessen at all?
No. I can share that with you on the air. We have contact with the psychologists and other professionals who have been a voice against this within the U.S. military and within other branches. The fact of the matter is that really I feel a deep pain for what happened to the U.S. military
right.
and what happened to the intelligence services. They were used in an irresponsible and unefficacious policy that produces bad intelligence, and they were given an order by the commander-in-chief, it now looks, to carry out a systematic regime of physical and psychological torture in contravention both of the law and of their values and the tradition of their service. So really, if this ends up, this whole scandal in American history ends up with a bunch of generals going down and a bunch of middle management or relatively senior management in the CIA facing some form of accountability, then we haven't succeeded mm-hmm. in true accountability. What it needs to be about is those who fundamentally authorized this policy and said that really what's at the heart of the American character is a nation that was really formed in response to tyranny that included torture.
Exactly.
by the British Empire. You know, we were one of the first militaries in the world, to go off on a tangent here, but I think it's really important. One of the first militaries in the world under George Washington, facing the greatest national security threat in the world, which is, we didn't even really have a state. And American service members in the Continental Army were being captured and tortured, and Washington chose a different path. And he said that we have to basically fight in the way that the values we're trying to defend demand us to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was with that the Washington Code was born, which ended up metamorphosing over time into what we now know as the Geneva Conventions.
The Geneva Accords, uh-huh.
And so really what's so tragic about this whole episode is that it flies in the face of that tenet of both legal clarity and command accountability, and most of all, the American character as we have claimed it to be. Mm-hmm. And for me, that gives me more grief as much as anger.
So as you're watching these events unfolding, as you've said before, that if we only have consequences for, you know, high members of positions within the CIA, that's not enough for what Physicians for Human Rights is striving for. Does it go all the way to the commander-in-chief, and who is the ultimate responsible
underneath
party?
The Uniform Code of Military Justice, underneath international laws of war, it is a system of command accountability. And it goes, in that sense, all the way to the top. But really, at the end of the day, accountability, the best measure of accountability in any situation, not just in terms of torture, but in any situation, the best type of accountability is policy change.
Yes.
And so at the end of the day, the number one priority for Physicians for Human Rights, for I think the human rights community in general, is to end the policy and restore the legal standard. Because to sort of channel Raymond Carver here, who said, what do we talk about when we talk about love? What do we talk about when we talk about torture? We're not just talking about torture. We're talking about the legalization of a felony crime that includes with it, as we're now seeing in the Department of Justice investigation, the destruction of the CIA tapes, potential obstruction of justice, potential doctoring of coroner's
evidence.
Reports, and all sorts of other types of evidence. We're talking about basically one instance that actually reverberates throughout the whole architecture of our law, because it says two things. One, that the standard now, as the Bush administration interprets it, is based on circumstances, that you can engage in felony crime if the circumstances are appropriate on the legal fiat of the commander-in-chief. The other thing it's saying is that the standard is not about, we don't say that only certain types of murder are wrong. No, murder's wrong. And now we're saying with torture, it has to rise to a certain limbo stick. Well, that flies in the face of all domestic and international law on torture.
Can you give us an example of how the circumstance concept would play out in ordinary life?
Well, it's sort of like you're having a few drinks at a bar with your friends. You're out there with, you know, your girlfriend or boyfriend or what have you, and you say it was okay to stab that guy with a pool cue because he looked at my girlfriend or boyfriend funny. That is not a legal defense. and in terms of current U.S. law on torture, it's saying, well, if that person was potentially a threat, not proven, not even with any standard of proven guilt, but if that person is potentially a threat, then their rights are totally abrogated.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do basically whatever we want within a certain very muddy standard of what is harm. And then how can you have law if that's the case? It's about bright lines. And what happened with torture really, as I said before, can affect the rest of our architecture as a country that's about the rule of law when the bright lines get muddy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It reminds me actually of one of the stories we've been following here at Sferio, and those of you who might have caught the Free Speech Radio News program tonight would have heard about this as well. The Suchitoto 13 in El Salvador currently being prosecuted under an anti-terrorist law for essentially standing up and having peaceful protests against the privatization of the water source in their hometown of Suchitoto. Similarly, the accusation there, and obviously, you know, this is an entirely different country, but I think that the paradigm is similar. You know, they've been put into a framework of potential terrorists, and therefore they are, you know, we can do whatever we want with them. It is worth mentioning that anti-terrorist law in El Salvador was actually designed with the U.S. anti-terrorism laws in mind. It was taken directly from our law.
So instead of being a bad policy example, we should try to be a good policy example, which is my next question, Nathaniel. What exactly would be the policy change? Specifically, what policies would you be advocating? Is it bringing us in line with the Geneva Conventions? Is it going further than that? Or what would be the policy that we should have regarding advanced interrogation techniques?
Well, it's time to go back to the future. And what that means is that we're a nation that has, especially in terms of our military, has led the world as a professional, legally governed military. Though there's My Lai and so many other examples, the fact of the matter is, for a professional military, we have been the creme de la creme of Geneva-abiding militaries on a global level. And what we need to do is go back to the standards that existed. Go back to the tenets of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which are based, without getting too wonky here, based on, which I'm always in danger of doing, which is based on Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention, which has a minimum standard for detainee treatment in any scenario. And to do that, there's a bill right now that has been passed by the House, and that if the Senate can get past a filibuster threat, it will pass, which makes Army Field Manual the unified standard for CIA and for DOD. That document would bring us back to where we need to be and put the CIA underneath one code of law, which is Geneva law.
I'd like to just ask a question from my lack of knowledge of CIA and military governance. Aren't they already following the Army Field Manual?
In the Army.
In the Army, but not in the CIA, basically.
Well, the issue is right now is that the Department of Defense, it has, under Secretary Gates, has come a long way from where we were under Secretary Rumsfeld. Now, that is not to say that the Military Commissions Act, which is a Department of Defense operation, the military commissions trying suspected terrorists at Guantanamo, which denies habeas corpus, that itself is not a massive human rights abuse. It is. And indefinite detention, Guantanamo, is a massive human rights abuse. It is. But when we're talking specifically about interrogation techniques, that right now is the province of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole, everything, you know, for people listening, everything you're hearing in the news tonight and this week about what was said at the White House, what was said by CIA Director Hayden, Attorney General McCasey, Vice President Cheney, all that comes back to trying to have a separate legal standard for the CIA so they do not have to follow the Army Field Manual. That's what it comes down to. Pure and simple, they want to literally allow them to get away with at least torture.
If not murder.
If we those Army Field standards, you mentioned that there was a sort of a minimum standard of care or treatment for detainees. What are those minimum standards?
Well, the minimum standard is that it's. I'm going to give you the official standard and then give you a couple details here. It's about preserving the overall health and dignity of the detainee, and so what does that mean in practice? It means that you cannot use coercive techniques like the enhanced interrogation techniques that affect the dignity and the health of the subject. You cannot deny them equal standards of care in terms of medical treatment, in terms of housing, equal to your own personnel. It basically says that you have to not use the conditions of detention to negatively affect the subject for purposes of either just general humiliation and breaking the will of that person or intelligence purposes, that basically you have to provide them three hots and a cot, but also more than that, you have to provide for their dignity. And mm-hmm. that's the Geneva standard. And we are, in terms of the Department of Defense, moving there. We're getting mm-hmm. there. But the issue is that the Department of Defense is just one department in the U.S. government, and the CIA right now is literally abiding by a separate standard, which has no precedent in U.S. law.
Hmm. And they have a wider variety of ability to operate within their special standard than it sounds like they've ever had before as well.
Well, let's talk about what that standard is. We know from investigative reports from journalists that there were at least 10 primary tactics being used by the CIA. Sensory deprivation, sleep deprivation, isolation, stress positions, temperature manipulation, dietary manipulation, waterboarding, the attention grab, which means hitting someone, and manipulation of phobias, and manipulation of the overall psychological profile of the subject. So what to put that basically is that you can hold someone underneath the enhanced interrogation program for years in a windowless cell with either extremes of sensory contact or extremes of sensory deprivation, and you can manipulate their entire environment with the purpose of causing, in CIA terminology, triple D, dread, debility, and deprivation, which is at the heart of that program.
So you're talking about loud sounds of, you know, loud music, sudden darkness, bright lights, all these types of things.
Which I think many we've become so fixated on waterboarding. You know, waterboarding is
the key word now.
Yeah, it's interrogation tactic du jour. But we wrote a report called Leave No Marks, which is the first. It looks at the risk of criminality in the enhanced tactics. And what we look at is the medical literature and legal literature. And what we see is that any of these tactics separately or as they're used in combination most of the time cause severe and prolonged harm, which violates even the Bush administration's muddied legal definition.
And I think it's interesting that there's sort of these nice names for all of the different techniques, you know, sensory manipulation or temperature manipulation, which sort of doesn't capture, I think, the extremity or the intensity of the torture that would be involved in, for example, sensory deprivation. And I think it's just interesting that you can put these nice names to something that makes it sound very benign, but that it actually is extremely harmful.
Well, you know, as I was talking to my colleague, Dr. Alan Keller from the Bellevue Center for Assisting Survivors of Torture, he's out and about doing more assessments of released detainees right now. But he told me today, he said a great line. He said, words have meaning. And when we lose the meaning of words like torture, when we lose the meaning of words like assault, words like battery, then basically we are trying to take away the reality of the crime. Mm-hmm. and we're talking about criminal acts here. And it really, I'm excited because I think it's going to be an important report. Physicians for Human Rights is releasing in April the first major study of psychological and medical evaluations of released detainees from Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And it's going to be called Broken Laws, Broken Lives, Medical Evidence of the Systematic Use of Torture by U.S. Forces. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be, I think, an important report because it goes beyond everything I'm saying now is this legal gobbledygook. But I want to get really to the heart of it, which is the human impact on actual human beings who have their lives basically demolished by this stuff.
Exactly.
And we can't forget that. What do we talk about when we talk about torture? We're talking about broken lives.
Yeah. So you're listening to Sferio, the local voice of our hemisphere, here on WMBR Cambridge. And we are talking to Nathaniel Raymond, who is from Physicians for Human Rights, about torture. And I think later on we'll be talking more about the role of physicians specifically in this torture and other various topics.
One thing I'd like to mention before we take a little break is that you can actually get a copy of Leave No Marks on the internet. It's available as a PDF file, and you can look that up yourself and read through it. I believe it was one of the very first, you were one of the very first organizations to print anything about this particular topic, which is just commendable. At any rate, physiciansforhumanrights.org is the website. Is that right?
I think that's correct.
Right. So we'll go to a little musical break, and then we'll come back and talk some more, more specifically about the physicians component.
Sure, and if you'd like to give us a call in the studio while we're in our musical interlude, we can answer the phone, answer any questions you have. 617-253-8810.
Y aunque hemos estado hablando nada más que inglés esta vez, saben que siempre pueden hablar con nosotros en español. Sus comentarios son siempre bienvenidos al número 617-253-8810. Oye, mujer,
Hey, good looking. Want to play with me?
Paul here. Anything come in for me? Yeah, I know. Jack, you've never heard anything like this. Blazing, red-hot, vintage rock and roll, country and western, and rhythm and blues on Backwoods. I coined the term. Every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 with John Funky. Don't mention that name. Here on WMBR in Cambridge. 88.1, first on your FM dial, Backwoods. It's more than a radio show. It's the tip of the icebox.
Bye-bye. See you later, alligator.
And you can catch the Crazy Backwoods Show on Saturdays. But right now, of course, it's Friday, and you are listening to Sferio, the local voice of our hemisphere. This is Amy Battistiache. We've got Kendra Johnson also in the studio. And our special guest with us today, Nathaniel Raymond from the Physicians for Human Rights. While we were listening to the music of Carmelina, Totó la Mompocina from Colombia, we actually had a caller call in from Concord, Mass., talking, concerned about our use of the Army Field Manual as a sort of admirable standard to hold the CIA to. I think that's worth mentioning because, Sferio is probably one of the first people or groups of people to say that we don't necessarily think that the U.S. Army is the greatest source of human rights abiding citizens. But it is perhaps a place to start, given that if we're trying to advocate for reining in the CIA from a pretty much uncontrolled, special category of law, right, then that might be a beginning.
Do you have a response to that, Nathaniel, in terms of what would you say to somebody who claims that the Army Field Manual is not strict enough standards and that there's too many abuses within that?
Well, I hope that caller is still listening because there's a section of the Army Field Manual that Physicians for Human Rights has significant problems with. It's called Appendix M, and it deals with separation and also hooding, a form of sensory deprivation of subjects. We feel that section of the manual needs to be reviewed and improved. And we have said that. We're one of the only human rights groups who has strongly pushed the Department of Defense privately and publicly through many ways to improve that section. But this is the point I want to make to the caller, if he or she is still out there, is that it's about getting back on the platform,
right,
of the law. The law can be changed, the law can be clarified, but the fact is with the CIA operating with a legal standard that is outside the law, we are unable to control their activities as the people that they work for. They work for us. And the fact of the matter is that the Army Field Manual is about the rule of law, and we can disagree with aspects of it, as Physicians for Human Rights does, and I'm sure as that caller does. But that's where we have to begin with the unified standard and improve it. And compared to basically a almost anything goes approach in terms of the enhanced techniques, which allows for torture, we need to start with Army Field Manual and improve from there.
Mm-hmm. Nathaniel, what sort of to take the backside of the question, if we are able to, and you said there were bills that's passed the House, and if it passes a filibuster in the Senate, that actually would make that change and bring the CIA back under this rule of law.
If the president doesn't veto.
And then perhaps we might have to wait until a new administration enters for it actually to be signed. Once that happens, then what will the CIA be able to do? How are they going to be able to get information out of the detainees?
Well, I it's important here, as we were talking during the break, to mention to all of you listening, is that the Federal Bureau of Investigation in all of this, both in terms of revealing what happened at Guantanamo by complying with the Freedom of Information Act and showing the systematic abuse that was happening there through FBI files, the protests of FBI agents during the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, the subject of the destroyed CIA tapes, FBI agents saying that we will not be in the room for these types of tactics because they go against both good intelligence gathering and also against, most importantly, U.S. law. And any evidence, listen to the E word, evidence that the FBI collects has to be admissible in court. And the FBI is, you know, it was the FBI that got the names of the, according to an article in The New Yorker by Lawrence Wright about FBI, ex-FBI interrogator Ali Safwan, it was the FBI that got the names of the hijackers through interrogations of sources in Yemen that really hinged on Ali Safwan's knowledge of Arabic and knowledge of the Quran and building rapport with the subjects, and it was that success that gave us the names of the hijackers, and that success came from the FBI through rapport building.
So that's the sort of interrogation techniques that they would have to revert to is dialogue instead of physical.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and be naive about the fact that the FBI behavioral analysis unit, the FBI interrogations unit from Quantico, plays hardball in interrogations. I'm sure it's not all rapport building. But the fact is that this is back to the point here. It's not about the techniques. It's about the legal standard. And when you have clear, bright-line legal guidance, it doesn't get down into this, you know, how much can I hit a subject? It comes down into, okay, here are the lines in the road, and we need to stay between those lines. And so for organizations like the FBI that have had to do this for decades, long before 9/11 and long after 9/11, they'll have to do this as well. They have required clear legal guidance. They already had that. We don't need to reinvent the wheel here. We need to allow our laws to be laws.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Sorry to sound like a broken record.
Yeah. No, and I think it's an interesting point that you make, that even if a law isn't perfect, there's ways to continue to struggle to change it, but that if something's outside of the law, then there's nothing that we can even
think about. The Voter Rights Act, think about the Civil Rights Act, all the critical pieces of legislation that made up the U.S. Civil rights movement victories of the 1960s did not happen fully formed and fully born. And even now, we are continuing to revisit that legislation to refine. And as we hopefully grow as a nation, our laws grow with us and they get better. And they only get better when we're engaged with institutions and we're engaged in the process and we demand higher standards. So, you know, social justice is like football. Sometimes you have the long ball and you move it 40 yards. Sometimes you're running it half a yard, you get knocked back, and then, you know, got to throw it for two. It's about sticking with it to get the highest standard possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a question about how Physicians for Human Rights, you were mentioning, you know, one of the main ways that you do your work is, for example, writing this report that's going to come out about the actual health consequences of the torture that people received in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib. And I'm wondering what kind of, if any, efforts you make or relationships you have with physicians or health providers that are actually engaged right now in sort of facilitating or working with the torture that's happening now, you know, okaying people to continue to receive torture or treating people when they come out or that kind of a thing. Do you engage with those sort of physicians or support them in any way, or is there what kind of attitude is that?
Well, the best way that we can support any health professional that's in a national security setting, and the way PHR has been doing it, is by making sure that the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Psychological Association, basically the three critical health professional associations in the United States, provide their members with clear guidance. Because without getting too much into the association politics of this, that especially in the case of the psychologists, even now, though it's improved, it was basically asking psychologists to be the judge of an ethical situation and the judge, the jury, and the lawyer for themselves about what was an appropriate way to participate. And we have a clear ethical standard, and that is do no harm, the Hippocratic Oath, which in many forms goes throughout health professions, whether physician or psychologist or nurse. And the fact of the matter is that the best thing we can do for those health professionals in national security settings who are trying to protect the United States but also adhere to their ethical obligations is to have their licensing associations tell them clearly what is appropriate for them to do and what is, to use a medical term, the Latin nola tangere, which means do not touch. And that's what we've been doing. And I think we have heard, and we work very closely. One of our senior advisors is retired Brigadier General Stephen Zanakis, former commander of Southeast Medical Command. And so he and others have really been able to open up that dialogue and say, how can Physicians for Human Rights support you and get you that bright line guidance?
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like those agencies do have pretty clear guidance right now for health professionals?
I think that the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association, which is a affiliate of the AMA, has said clearly no direct participation in these interrogations. The American Psychological Association, however, has said that psychologists can still directly participate, which is something we disagree with, but we worked very hard with the American Psychological Association to have them prohibit participation in a very expansive list of enhanced interrogation tactics that we have known through press reports and government documents have been used in these abusive and criminal interrogations. And so the APA has gone halfway. Now it's time for them to affirm the critical principle, which is what the AMA and the American Psychiatric Association has done, and say there is no role for a health professional whose critical obligation is to be a healer to the patient, not to have a dual loyalty to the state that comes above the patient. Yeah, and so the American Psychological Association is still not there. They're halfway there, but that's not all the way.
So what role are psychologists playing right now, you know, sort of whether or not it's adhering to that particular code, but within, you know, these enhanced interrogation techniques within torture, what roles are they playing?
Well, at Guantanamo, there's still the presence of what's called biscuits, which is a fun word to say.
Biscuits?
Biscuits, yes, like the flaky kind you have with gravy. It stands for Behavioral Science Consultative Teams. And at one point, those teams included psychiatrists until they refused to participate and were taken off the island. They were sort of voted off the island.
They were voted off the island. Yeah,
they voted themselves off. And now you still have psychologists who are involved in those behavioral science consultative teams, which basically means psychologists who are providing advice to interrogators, which includes the psychological weaknesses of the subject, which means using their health professional expertise to calibrate what could be harm to the subject. And so basically, that is one role they're still playing, and there is no evidence to suggest, one way or the other, that the use of psychologists from the SEER program, or SERI as some people say it, in the CIA interrogations has ended. And so hopefully someday there will be accountability, but until we know, we have to assume they're still involved.
Hmm. And is that something that Physicians for Human Rights will take on in a direct way, or are you more...
We're going to take it to the mattresses, to quote The Godfather. this is the critical issue for a group that promotes health through protecting human rights and promotes health and human rights through protecting and promoting medical ethics. the participation of health professionals to either legitimate or to torture, to implement torture, to design it in any way is a travesty that flies in the core concepts of being a health professional.
Mm-hmm.
You are not a calibrator of harm. You are not an inflictor of terror. You are a healer of mind and body, and that is your role. If you want to be an interrogator or intelligence operative, then be an interrogator or an intelligence operative, but don't continue to be a professional with a code of ethics that stands clearly in any interpretation against these types of activities.
Yeah. I mean, it goes with the who are you loyal to? I mean, can you imagine the patient that you're using your expertise that should be there to be helping the patient with whatever psychological issues they might be having, and instead feeding that right to the person who's going to exploit them?
That's a huge part of the problem.
We are finishing up our hour in the studio with Nathaniel Raymond, one of the
senior strategists? I'm saying one of the. I'm assuming there are multiple senior strategists, or maybe you are.
We have a very collective approach. There are many senior strategists.
Like the Sperio Collective.
Like the Sperio Collective. We have many senior co-hosts. Yes. At any rate, senior strategists for Physicians for Human Rights. Thank you so much for coming and talking with us. And we have a little more time here before we have to say goodbye. I just quickly wanted to ask you, I understand this is obviously the area that you focus on, but Physicians for Human Rights does many other campaigns and does much investigation about other things as well. Can you kind of give us a brief
sure.
sense of some of the other irons in the fire, as it were?
We have one of our hallmark campaigns is called Health Action AIDS, which is a campaign focusing on stopping the spread of AIDS and other infectious diseases such as malaria in Africa, really focusing on building the voices of African health professionals in their own societies, and then to push for increased resources for building healthcare infrastructure in African countries. Another thing we work very deeply on is the use of science through forensics in both providing justice mm-hmm. for victims of mass war crimes and other atrocities, closure for the families through identification of the victims and of the living as well. And so that's a real core part of our tradition. The last thing is we shared the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for helping found the International Campaign to Ban Landmines.
Right.
And really our roots are in that type of documentation and campaigning that was central to the signing of the Mine Ban Treaty. So that's what just a bit of what Physicians for Human Rights is about. Check us out on the web, physiciansforhumanrights.org.
And that's all spelled out and all run together as one word.
Exactly.
I believe it's also possible, if there are people listening who are interested, to volunteer with Physicians for Human Rights.
We take volunteers, we take donors, we take people signing up for our e-community to get involved in our campaigns, and there's all sorts of things you can do, whether you're a health professional or just a person who cares about these issues.
Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing all of this with us here tonight.
Well, I appreciate you having me on.
So I think now we have a few announcements to share with everyone.
We do indeed, and what that means is that it's time for the announcement music. Yes, it's Sperio announcement time. Kendra didn't know I was going to do that, see?
Sperio announcement time. So the first announcement is that another student organization here at MIT that I'm very involved with called Share a Vital Earth is hosting a big, giant symposium next week at MIT.
It's not just big, it's big it's and giant.
Big and giant, yes. And taking up all of my time right now. But there's a lot of really fascinating events that we're going to be hosting. The idea is to get students and graduate students and also community members from the Boston area to become engaged in climate change and looking at it from all sorts of disciplines, because this challenge isn't going to just be taken care of by the climatologists and the nuclear engineers, but by everyone. So the website for that is climatechange.mit.edu. And there's a whole host of events happening at various times during the day on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week. There's 11 of them, so I'm not going to list them all, but there's things running the gamut from climatologists talking about climate models and how to integrate climate models and make policy out of them and make economic policy out of them. And, things like people who work in the Media Lab at MIT talking about how to use technology to get people to interact with their environment. And if you bring your laptop, you can make your own interactive media during the second portion of that event. And we also have, political science sort of aspects of it, chemical engineers, chemists, all sorts of different things. So check that out at climatechange.mit.edu. It's open to the general public, and everyone's welcome to come. And then we also have some interesting news from the MIRA Coalition.
That is true. Actually, there is news, and there are things that we wanted to share that are coming up. The first thing that is coming up is actually not Mira sponsored specifically, but Mira the is one of the organizations involved in it. There is a lobby day on MCAS reform that will be happening next Wednesday. If you're not going to be involved in the event that that Kendra is just telling you about, perhaps you might have time to go to the State House in Boston beginning at 10:30 a.m. If you are concerned about the MCAS, that would be the high-stakes exam that all students are required to pass in order to graduate from high school in Massachusetts now. The group will be asking legislators and the governor, Governor Patrick, to ensure high-quality education by reforming the MCAS. So that will be Wednesday. Don't you just love the announcement music? I just had to say that. The other thing that that Mira would like us to announce for you is that they're looking for people who have experienced problems with the immigration backlog. Mira is, among other things, a group that records and gathers information that can be of benefit to the immigrant communities here in Massachusetts. If you know anyone who's affected by the delays of the citizenship backlog and name check specifically, that would be if you're applying for citizenship, but there's been a great delay in your paperwork being taken care of. You can either contact Mira directly, or you can, you know, assuming you get this approved from your friend, you can say what your friend's name is to Mira. And what they would like, ideally, would be a sort of a write-up of what's going on. What has your experience been? You can email kdebosset, that is the letter K, and then DEBEAUSSET, at miracoalition.org with any of that above information.
And you can also, as always, email us at sferio@wmbr.org if you have questions or didn't catch any of the announcements and would like to find out more about them. sferio@wmbr.org. And finally, as always, a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT.
And that's about it for us here at Sferio today. Join us again next week and every Friday, at least until further notice.
6 to 7 p.m., Sferio.
Stay tuned for music
for human beings.
After these special messages from WMBR Cambridge, 88.1 FM.
Listen carefully. What you are about to hear can save your life.
The Intercontinental is coming your way every Wednesday from 6 to 8 p.m., digging up international impurities for your listening pleasure. Yugoslavian mariachi, Inuit hip-hop, Indian brass bands, as well as psychedelic rock and hip-hop in every language but English. And when appropriate, we'll cover the traditions as well. So remember, The Intercontinental with your host, Jesse Kaminsky, Wednesday from 6 to 8 p.m. on WMBR in Cambridge, for your ears only.
Not enough to help him grow. How can I fulfill his